The Great Studs Terkel on Music's Inspiration.
There was a poet named John Chardy of Providence, Rhode Island, and his family came from Italy. But all immigrants would buy a Caruso record. And he said the thing about Caruso is he let the human being know that was more to the human being that was now being expressed. He would do a song, say, O Paradiso, an aria from a little-known opera called L'Africain. And as he would sing, O Paradiso, he would come to the end. That's as high as you could go. He'd go one step further. And I told John Chardy that he sang something to the human species, that you are better than you're behaving at this moment, but you are more thoughtful than you are at this moment, that in you are all these possibilities that Caruso, as the artist supreme, found.
We hear my 2005 interview with Terkel on this holiday episode. Also, food psychologist Brian Wansing gives us tips on how not to overeat. Good advice for this time of year. And Native American scholar Marge Bruschek tells the true story of Thanksgiving. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Reaching back into the archives for a holiday treat to bring you, I found a 2005 interview I did with the late great radio man and chronicler of 20th century life, Studs Terkel. Long a hero of mine, I leaped at the chance to interview him when, at the age of 92, he came out with his last book, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. A homage to the power of music to bring out the best in humanity, the book features conversations Terkel had with some of the greatest musicians of the last century. Those conversations happened on his famed daily radio show on WFMT in Chicago. And They All Sang was his 14th book. The first book I ever read by Terkel was his 1974 oral history, Working.
Do you know something? This book called And We All Sang, They All Sang, the subtitle, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, and we'll talk about that word eclectic in a minute. This book, in a way, is a sequel to Working. Instead of the non-celebrated, I don't like celebrities to begin with, those who are celebrated for being so, well, Albert Einstein is celebrity, that's a different thing. George Bernard Shaw is celebrity, but I mean those who are celebrated for being celebrated. No, I find that a working or a so-called ordinary person, a phrase I don't like because it's patronizing, but the non-celebrated person who makes the wheels go round, interviewed for the first time, is a very exciting experience for that person and for me. I'll give you a quick example before we come to the book, this one, on music. I was interviewing this woman, this is about, might have been 30, when I was just beginning the idea of working. I still call myself a disc jockey, though people call me an oral historian, etc. But I'm a disc jockey, a guy with records originally. And so I'm interviewing this woman, and she's in a housing project, and to this day I can't recall whether she was white or black. She was light-skinned, very pretty, very skinny, bad teeth because of no dental money, and three little kids, 5, 6, 7 years old, running around. They want to hear mommy's voice. She's never been interviewed in her life before. So I say to the kids, you be quiet, and I'm going to play your mommy's voice. And so I play her voice. As she hears her voice for the first time in her life, she puts her hand to her mouth and says, oh, my God. I said, what is it? She says, I never knew I felt that way before. Well, that is a bingo for me and for her. It's that kind of stuff that excites me. So in a way, this book is about musical artists, either singers or musicians, in the world of classical or jazz or folk or spirituals, who are telling about their vocation, their work, in that way, it's a sequel to Working.
And they are also, you know, all these folks are pretty famous, but there's an awful lot of homage in this book also to regular, ordinary folks who just make music.
That's right. In the main, they're artists whom I admired, some known to many, some not. Certain opera singers who may or may not be known, like Tito Gobbi, the great Scarpia of our time. Scarpia was the villain of Tosca, the police chief before whom all Rome trembled. Remember, he tries to make out with Tosca, but she wants to save her lover, Cavaradossi, who's one of the revolutionaries. This is not too long after the French Revolution, and so he's a marvelous singer. He wants to show not just the mean spiritedness of the guy, but a certain drop of humanity in him. But then his favorite aria is in a little-known Verdi opera. It's called Simone Boccanegra, and Simone, as in Simon, it was the doge, that's the mayor of a nation state, Genoa. This is back in the 14th century, 500 years before Garibaldi and Mazzini and the unification of Italy. And so here's a song. The old man is now dying, Boccanegra, and he and his opponent, his enemy, another old man, both are dying. And they say, what the hell have we been doing to the young people? We've killed them. Let there be peace. And so he sings this aria called Proletari, Proletari, Plebi, Plebeians, Patrici, another word, and it's a plea for peace. So there are two aspects to his life, he writes. Others are there, and these are classical part. Andre Segovia, the great guitarist, 80 years old with that classical instrument. No electrification. 5,000 people hear those notes and lean forward as he plays, say, his transcription of a Bach piece on the guitar, and they listen. And one comes over at the end who likes Segovia. He says, but you played too low. I had to sit forth and hear hard. So you know what he did the next time? He played it even lower. And so the person leaned even more. And he says, that's our attention sometimes. And so I go from there to Bob Dylan to Dizzy Gillespie working with Charlie Parker on a new form of jazz.
I loved your piece on Mahalia Jackson.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the few pieces in the book that's actually your own writing. And a lot of people credit you with, quote, discovering her, but you make a different point.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, the father of gospel music, and I'll explain the difference in different gospel music and spirituals, but the father, his name is Professor Thomas A. Dorsey, and he was a bunch of jazz player, accompanist of Ma Rainey, who was the teacher of Bessie Smith, and when his wife died, he was saved, you know, theologically saved. And so he played all these gospel songs, a lot of songs he wrote for Mahalia, Precious Lord, Take My Hand, which was, you know, Martin Luther King's favorite song. And he said he was paying tribute to me. You, Studs Terkel, have let us know about... Well, it's so wrong. I was the first white, and that's the point, white disc jockey to do it. But she was known to African-American people by the millions in this country. But until the white guy does it. So that was why I kept that in as a sad commentary. Of course she was known. I was close to her, that's true. And I did MC a network show of hers. Well, Mahalia has a way of singing, because I first heard that, a song called Move On Up a Little Higher. I never heard a voice like that.
And you say that you heard it everywhere you went.
Well, that's the whole point. You just touched a thing I am combating. The line separating them. It shouldn't. I'm gonna move.
Gonna move on up a little higher. Gonna regret. Gonna move on up a little higher. Gonna meet my lovely mother. I'm gonna move on up a little higher.
You see, very often you find, like my friend John Donahue, was leader of the coalition, ex-priest. No, he still was a priest. Leader of the coalition with the homeless. His father was a lifetime Chicago fireman, firefighter. And his father's one regret was he never told his firehouse buddies that he loved opera. Now we come to something very important, and that's what my program through these years tried to do, and that's what I try to do in this book, to show there is no high or low culture, that any person can love Bach or a lead by Schubert or a piece by Mozart. Anyone, and this I tell the story of this young British working man who was very thoughtful about everything, but he thought classical music, Beethoven or Mahler or Bach, is not for him. It's people who see on the society page, opening night of the opera or symphony. It's for the woman with the tiara on her head, or the guy with white gloves and a cane. And then one day, it's raining hard, and he wants to gather, he hops into this hallway, and it's a music hall, a symphony hall. And he hears music. He opens the door of the auditorium, and he hears this music, and suddenly he's entranced by it. And it's Mozart. And I listened, he says, and I listened, and I liked it. It lifted me. Suddenly I realized, hey, he wrote this for me, too. That's the point, you see. And they did, as a matter of fact. Some of the great pieces were based upon folk songs of the time. You got Modern Jazz Quartet, a wonderful jazz group, playing Bach. And they play one of his pieces, Ye Ye Su Joy, A Man's Desiring. It's something Bach himself would have loved, because folk music was also the seeds planted of some of the great pieces.
Well, some people say that jazz is the American classical music.
No, it's American music. It should be, well, it could be, it's America's contribution to the world, of course. We know that. When Dizzy Gillespie, instead of sending guys with guns over to, forgive me, free Iraq, oh boy, when someone does that, that doesn't win friends. But Dizzy Gillespie in the Middle East, these are people we consider the enemy. They lifted him by the shoulders. The music is something they loved. So it's America's contribution to the world. But it's not our classical music. It's just part of the music.
And Leonard Bernstein says in your book that...
Well, Bernstein gave me the title.
Really?
He said, and we all sang. In the olden days, he's not against technology and tapings and all the new things. But something is happening to the human voice that is lost in the process. He says, in the olden days, everybody singing was like conversation, was part of a cultivated person's life. Singing. And he says, that is a great deal of that is lost. Now, I feel it very keenly because I'm going deaf, deaf as a post. I'm known as the great listener. I'm as deaf as they come. Me and Beethoven.
That's right.
And so the point is, he's saying an experience I have when I call on the phone in the old days. I'd say, ask for a friend of mine. Is Charlie Andrews there? He says, no, he's not. Could you tell him Studs called? And the human voice is, sure. Now today I call and I say, Charlie's at work. And I dread calling because I get a mechanical voice that says, if you want so-and-so, dial 1. If you want supplies, dial 2. If you want whatever, we got dial. By the time they get the 6, I don't know who I called or what I called about.
You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking that most of the voices, perhaps even all of them, had been formed in a time that predates the total takeover of music by big corporations. And in fact, this came out of the Bernstein article, the Bernstein interview, because he talks about the record business as being almost as big as cocaine. And he also talks about the dumbing down, the kind of instant gratification culture. And I think that that's a piece with what you're saying, that there's a loss of the intimate human voice here.
See, that's the sad part. Seeking something phony and deleterious to health, whether it be mental health or physical health. Seeking what? Immediate gratification. What is greater gratification than that working man hearing Mozart for the first time and caught by it? What is greater gratification than hearing a piece by Louis Armstrong, West End Blues, my favorite jazz, with his exploring the trumpet the way he did? The trumpet becomes his voice becomes the trumpet, and his partner in this particular recording, Earl Hines, revolutionizes the piano. What is greater satisfaction than hearing a ballad, a Dust Bowl ballad of the Depression days, sung by Woody Guthrie, who, by the way, influenced Bob Dylan very, very much.
From the California to the New York Island and the Redwood Forest.
And now that interview was a long time ago with Bob Dylan.
Oh, 1962. Some of these interviews, strange, I'm glad you asked that. Some of the interviews were done 50 years ago. I've done this for a long time. And it doesn't matter when it was done. Does it fit today? The description of Tito Gobbi, the great opera, Scarpia, villain describing him and his two feelings, or a wonderful Helden tenor, a Wagnerian tenor named John Vickers, who is great, who didn't like Wagner, by the way. But he describes, he's in an opera called, a contemporary one called Peter Grimes by the English composer Benjamin Britten. It's about the outsider. The whole village doesn't like Peter Grimes. He's a good man, but he can't express the feelings he has. And so it drives them crazy. So the conformists, let's say, putting down and finally killing someone who is different, the outsider. So that stuff always attracted me.
Peter Grimes, Peter Grimes, Peter Grimes. Peter Grimes, we are here to investigate the cause of death of your apprentice, William Stone, whose body you brought ashore from your boat, the boy Billy, on the 26th Ultimo. Do your ways to give evidence.
And Dizzy Gillespie describing how he and Charlie Parker got together and revolutionized jazz with bop following World War II. And Dizzy speaks of jazz, the greatest American ambassador is, better than any bombing plane, better than any artillery you can name. He was in the Middle East facing those others, and they lifted him on their shoulders. They were so excited by the music that is so American, called jazz, now so universal.
That's a theme that runs through the book also. There's a kind of profound humanist current that runs through most, if not all, of these musicians. profound sense of connection with the world and with larger issues. Is that something that you think you might have elicited by the kind of interview you had, or is that something that was in those people?
You know, that's a good question, you see. How can you separate music from life, you see? Music is the basis. You know, Enrico Caruso, if there's a hero to this book, it's the greatest of all opera singers. He used to opera with Babe Ruth, who was the bass player, what Charlie Chaplin was to early movies. That art form, or that sports form, and that guy with well, Caruso, no voice like his. And I got a couple of old-time prima donnas, now long since dead, who spoke with him, who sang with him. And they speak of his generosity of spirit. But the big thing about him, there was a poet named John Chardy of Providence, Rhode Island, and his family came from Italy. But all immigrants would buy a Caruso record. And he said the thing about Caruso is he let the human being know that was more to the human being that was now being expressed. He would do a song, say, O Paradiso, an aria from a little-known opera called L'Africaine. And as he would sing O Paradiso, he would come to the end. That's as high as you could go. He'd go one step further. And I told John Chardy that he's saying something to the human species, that you are better than you're behaving at this moment, but you are more thoughtful than you are at this moment, that in you are all these possibilities that Caruso, as the artist supreme, found. So it's that sort of, when you ask, is it connected with, well, of course it is. You can't separate it. In the opera, Tosca, the heroine, sings a great aria called Vici d'Arte. That's a famous Vici. You know, life and my art. My life and art are one. And that's what the book's about, too.
That was the great Studs Terkel, talking with us in December 2005. He died in 2008 at the age of 96. Next up, we hear my 2006 interview with food psychologist Brian Wanzink. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There are many drivers of the obesity epidemic. The thing is, there's food everywhere, and portions tend to be supersized. How can we resist the temptation that lures us from all sides? Food psychologist Brian Wanzink has the answer. Back in 2006, we spoke with him about his book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Here's an abridged version of that interview. Wanzink is the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, which has a restaurant called The Spice Box. That's one of the places where the lab scientists test the eating behaviors of their subjects.
We might change the name or label on a wine and see how it influences how much of a meal people eat. We might change the lighting. We might have something unusual happen that throws people off to see how they respond in the way they eat. It enables us to test the very specific things that we think are almost invisible to most people, but which influence how much they eat or how much they like food.
Well, tell us some of those things. Like, for example, what happens when you change the label on a wine?
Okay. Well, we actually did do that in the Spice Box. What we did is we brought people in for a nice French prefix meal. And it was the middle of February and cold night. We said, hey, thanks for keeping your reservation. Because you kept the reservation, we'd like to offer you a complimentary glass of wine. And what we did was we had a very cheap bottle of $2 bottle of wine that we'd soaked the label off. And what we did is we put on fake labels, which said that it was either this Cabernet from California, a place known for wine, respected for wine, or we put on a label that said a Cabernet from North Dakota, not a place known for wine, not necessarily a place very well respected for wine. And we know from a prior study that when people end up drinking something that they believe is going to taste good, they do evaluate it as better. They essentially look for those good qualities and those good aspects, and their taste buds conveniently confirm their expectations. Well, in this case, we weren't interested in what wine tastes like. We were interested in how it influenced the rest of the meal. And what we found, if people thought they were eating a California, drinking a California wine, they loved the food, they ate 10 minutes longer, they ate 11% more of the food. If they had one from North Dakota, it just wasn't as good. They just finished up dinner and left, and they left a lot more of their food in their plate.
So their expectations determined how they actually tasted or enjoyed the food.
You know, absolutely. But, I mean, you know, we've known this for a lot of studies we've done in cafeterias. We've gone to cafeterias and to restaurants, and we've changed the names of the menus. So, you know, one week the menu item would be called seafood filet, and the next week it'd be called succulent Italian seafood filet. Well, in reality, it's just like a dried-up fish stick. But the people who eat the thing that they believe is a succulent Italian seafood filet, I mean, they rate the foods better, they rate the restaurants better, and after they finish eating, they actually believe that the chef has had probably 1 to 2 years of culinary training overseas.
Now, you've mentioned two things. One was a $2 bottle of wine.
Yeah, $2 chuck.
And the other is exactly $2 chuck. And the other was from a box of, I assume, frozen dried up fish sticks, right?
Yeah. So this is bad cafeteria seafood.
Yeah. So what is it that gets people to fool themselves that something tastes good that really doesn't taste that great?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, what's going on is we have so many things going in our life that our life pretty much becomes filled with mindless eating because we parallel process things. We end up doing a lot of stuff at the same time. And eating can be a fairly automatic activity, as can the evaluation of food. So we're probably more interested in what our dinner mates are talking about or how work's going or something like that. So the evaluation of food becomes very peripheral. And when something's very peripheral, we end up being very easily influenced by the little cues around us, whether it be names and labels or whether it be packages and plates or whether it be music and lighting.
So your book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And you also talk about something called the mindless margin. What is that?
Well, what happens is that the majority of people who gain weight in a year gain it at less than 2 to 3 pounds a year. I mean, that's a difference of 25 calories. And 25 calories extra a day is really, you know, nothing more than about 5 M&Ms or about 8 Tic Tacs. So there's very few calories we eat in excess every day that lead us to gain weight. The mindless margin is the number of calories we can trim out of our day without noticing it physiologically, without noticing it psychologically, that can end up leading to weight loss. And we estimate that very, very, very conservatively to be as much as 300 calories. Meaning if we come up with three little changes that cut 300 calories out of our day, we're not going to miss it from a physiological or psychological standpoint. We're not going to have headaches. We're not going to have stomach growling. But over the course of a year, 300 extra calories, 300 less calories a day translates into 30 less pounds at the end of the year. And that's the mindless margin.
And we're talking with Brian Wanzink, and the book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. You know, I have to say, I was really astonished. I mean, the idea that one could lose 30 pounds almost effortlessly, or that's going to be the subject of most of what we talk about today, how you actually do that, really surprised me. Have you seen this work with people? I mean, do you know people that's worked with?
Yeah, actually, we know it actually works for most of the people in the lab. Most of the people who start in the lab, we know what cues lead people to overeat, so we gradually find that people, you know, start doing the small things that our study suggests, and all of a sudden we find people losing quite a bit of weight very quickly. I mean, not very quickly, but over the course of the year, we'll find people will drop down to a low BMI very very quickly.
You mean your colleagues?
Yeah, my colleagues. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So let's talk about some of those cues. I have to say, this is a hugely entertaining book. And I had to laugh out loud at some of the experiments that you did. One of them was the bottomless soup bowl.
Well, what happens is most people believe they're master and commander of all their food choices. I mean, they believe that they know when they're full. In reality, we have very little idea when we're full sometimes because we end up eating largely with our eyes instead of our stomach. I mean, at the extremes, we'd know we were full, but in the middle, we're not really that aware of being full. And if you're to ask most people, when are you through eating? Most people would say, I'm pretty much through eating when the plate's empty or when my bowl's empty. We thought we'd figure out what happens if the plate never empties. What happens if your bowl never empties? And we designed these refillable soup bowls, these bottomless soup bowls, where we drilled holes in the bottom of bowls and we drilled holes through the table and connected using food-grade tubing the bowl through the table over to a big 6-quart cauldron of soup. Now, in doing this, a person could theoretically eat 6 quarts of soup before they ever hit the bottom of the soup bowl, because as they eat, the level goes down, but then it slowly, slowly, slowly refills itself. And what we find is that when we bring people in for lunch and they eat away, we stop them after 20 minutes. But they've eaten 73% more soup in a refillable soup bowl than they did a normal one. Yet, when we ask them to rate how full they are, they don't rate themselves as being any more full. Because after all, I mean, they've only eaten half a bowl of soup. There's still a half a bowl left. How can they be full?
But they did say that the soup was good and filling.
Yeah, they did. They did like the taste of the soup, even though they ended up, you know, eating it ad nauseum.
You know, how do you guys think up these experiments? You know, I have this image that you all sit around a table and you do a lot of chuckling.
Oh yeah, we do. We've got very funny people in the lab, and we've always, I mean, something you'd be attracted to something as non-traditional and academic as food psychology. That person's got to have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I decided I needed to go on a crash diet because I'm going to be going to an award ceremony. And actually, in all modesty, I'm going to be one of the people getting you an award for a documentary I did last year. And I thought, oh, my God, now I have got to lose those extra 10 pounds. So I went on the Atkins diet. Mm-hmm. And within 3 days, I'd had enough.
Well, I mean, that's one. One thing about that deprivation diets is people can lose weight on them, but not mere mortals. Boy, I think the people who can really lose a lot of weight on these, it's got to become a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune to work and write a number of things with Mike Huckabee, who's the governor of Arkansas, and who's ended up losing about 120 pounds in a year just through discipline and exercise. And so we know it can be done, but for most of us, most people don't want to lose 120 pounds. Most people would be happy. In fact, a recent study we did showed that most people, around 80%, would be happy if they lost 20 pounds or less,
mm-hmm.
Actually 18 pounds or less. And for 18 pounds or less, boy, going on a deprivation diet is just not going to cut it for most of us. It's a whole lot easier to just trim 100, 150 calories out of your day, and at the end of the year, you'll easily be 10 or 15 pounds less without even knowing you've been on a diet.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with food psychologist Brian Wansink about his book, Mindless Eating. You talked about the mindless margin, how we mm-hmm. mindlessly put on the weight. And, of course, that leads to also then, you know, setting things up in your life so that you mindlessly lose weight, I think, is kind of the point of your book.
Absolutely, yes.
I wanted to ask you, what are some of the major cues or major ways that people are mindless about food? I mean, you talked about, you know, that we're distracted a bit. I wonder if you could talk more about that and some of the other ways also that we set ourselves up for failing to lose weight.
Mm. Well, one thing is that we make over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, we think we make about 15. In reality, we make well over 200 food decisions a day. I mean, even for breakfast, we're deciding which cereal to have, but how much to pour, whether to put skim milk or whole milk, whether to put sugar on it, whether to cut a banana. We make 15 decisions before we even have a bite to eat. But the thing is, we're not even aware of having made those. And so at every one of those points when we make a decision, whether it be how much milk to pour or how much cereal to pour, we can easily be influenced by a peripheral cue that suggests that we maybe pour a little bit more than we otherwise would have. The bowl size, for instance, will encourage us to pour more. The size of the container of milk is going to lead us to pour more. A huge cereal box will have us pour more. Mm-hmm. All these things have very subtle influences. But as we know, hey, very small influences that just lead us to eat 25 calories more lead us to gain 2.5 pounds over the course of a year. And so that's what we need to target at turning around.
Now, what would you do with that? You know, you got your Cheerios box. You got the economy size. So it's a big one.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Well, I mean, you know, one thing would be as simple as say, you know, buy a smaller box. But, you know, that's ridiculous for a lot of us because we want to buy the economy size because we save a lot of money. An easier thing to do would just be to simply use smaller bowls and put the box of cereal not on the table, but leave it on the counter. Hey, you can have seconds if you want to, but we find that simply having something 6 feet away, whether it be a candy dish or a cereal box or a bowl of pasta, leads people to end up eating less over the course of their meal because at some point you just don't mindlessly pour another bowl. You say, hey, do I really want some? And that 6 feet gives you pause to say, am I really hungry? And oftentimes, half the time, in some of our studies, the answer is no.
Half the time.
Yeah, we did a series of studies that were it was fun. It was with secretaries at a university, and this was when I was at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we enlisted a number of secretaries in the study and gave them a month's worth of chocolates, these are Hershey Kisses, and put them. We either placed them on their desk, or we placed them just 6 feet from their desk, and every single night we went and refilled all these bowls, counting how many they'd eaten. And we found that the typical person with a bowl on their desk ended up eating about 9 of these Hershey Kisses every single day, which is about 225 calories. If it was moved just 6 feet off their desk, the exact same person would end up eating 4 candies, which is about 100 calories. So simply having it on her desk, if she did it every day for a year, she'd be 12 pounds heavier. But having it 6 feet, it was interesting when we did the debriefing and we talked to people and you say, was it, is it that much of a hassle just to walk 2 steps? Is that why you ate so few candies when it was moved off your desk? They'd say, no, it's not that it's much of a hassle. It's just that that 6 feet gave me pause to ask myself, hey, am I really that hungry? Half the time they asked themselves that, they came up with the answer, no.
Right, and also it was out of their line of vision. You know, it's funny you said secretaries in the universities because I just noticed that every secretary I know has a bowl of candy on her desk.
No, we call them social magnets. When we'll talk to people that are perpetually dieting, they'll say, hey, why do you have that bowl on your desk? You know what's going to happen. They go, yeah, but you know, it's a conversation piece. People come by, they'll stop by, they'll talk. I make people smile when they stop by. Well, hey, we've got about 400 candy dishes in our lab because that's basically, you know, a lot of that in the food lab. People stop by expecting to have food. But what we've done is we just replaced all the candy we like with candy we don't like. So instead of having the chocolates and things, we've replaced it with sweet and sour candies like, you know, sweet tarts and things like that, which we don't like quite so much. Hey, they're no temptation for us, but people still stop by.
And you mentioned portion, you know, the size of the bowl. What about the size of the food, the size of the portions? I mean, what's happened to these over the last, you know, in the last 30 years?
Oh, well, and the same thing has happened to our kitchens. They've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger because why? Well, because we can afford it, because we're a country with a lot of space. And so we're always looking for value. And the first time that a restaurant decides to increase the size of its fries by 25%, its competitors have a choice. They can either increase the size of their fries 25% and be seen as an equal bargain, or they can keep them where they're at and be seen as expensive. So what we have is sort of an escalation of competition among restaurants.
That was Brian Wanzink. I spoke with him in 2006 about his book, Mindless Eating. He teaches and researches the psychology of food at Cornell University. Next up, the real story of Thanksgiving.
How I got over. How did I make it over? You know my soul back in wonder. How did I make it over? How I made it over. Coming on over all these years. You know my soul look back and wonder, how did I make it over? Tell me how we got over, Lord. Had a mighty hard time coming on over. You know my soul look back.
Well, it's Thanksgiving time again, a time when Native American storyteller Marge Bruschak gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruschak co-authored the book 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We talked to her in 2005 and thought it was a good idea to bring it to you again today. I started out by asking Marge Bruschak what really happened way back then.
It was not a Thanksgiving. Thanksgivings to the Puritans were specific religious ceremonies. They often involved a day of prayer. They often involved a great deal of fasting. And feasts were an entirely different kind of activity. The feast was more like a harvest home feast, more sort of a carryover of old English harvest traditions. Thanksgivings for Native people were held on each of the 13 full moons of the year. So it just so happened that this coming together of Plymouth colonists and Wampanoag people happened near a full moon in the autumn and at a time of great hardship for the Plymouth colony. Because here's the thing. People often imagine that it was many, many Puritan pilgrims and a handful of Native people. But in fact, there were more than 90 Native people present. They were the vast majority. Of the colonists themselves, there were only 52 out of the original 103 English colonists still alive. Most of them had perished during the winter.
And how long had the colonists been here?
They had been there since November of the previous winter. And so there were only 4 adult women. There were only 16 adult males. And in addition, there were 9 seamen and servants who worked on the ship but were not considered members of the colony per se, and there were 23 children. So sometimes you see these 19th century illustrations of the feast as though all of these English women are feeding these poor starving Indians, when in fact there are over 90 of Massasoit's people, and then their women and children.
Who was Massasoit?
Massasoit was one of the key sachems of the Wampanoag people. He was a leader commonly known as a chief. His name, in fact, means great chief. His given name was Osemequin. So Massasoit is a title more than anything. He was from the Poconoka people, who are in present-day eastern Rhode Island. And his decision to form an alliance with the English was very strategic at that moment in time. At that moment, the Wampanoag were engaged in conflict with the Narragansett in present-day Rhode Island. And the Wampanoag thought it might behoove them to have good trading relations with a small English colony that they could carefully control. I think they had no idea that so many colonists would come. They understood that this small colony were religious separatists, they were iconoclasts. I think they thought this was a manageable group. And they also didn't understand the degree to which the colonists intended to take over Wampanoag territory. So, for instance, any so-called unimproved or wild or untilled land was considered the property of Christians, despite the fact that Native people had been living on it for millennia.
It considered by the pilgrims.
By the pilgrims.
Right.
I want to step forward into this timeline of how Thanksgiving morphs into an American holiday, because one thing that few people understand is the fact that most of the colonial Thanksgiving days were actually celebrations for victories over the Indians. So the first regional Thanksgiving celebrated in New England was actually in 1637 after the Pequot War. There were small individual days of Thanksgiving within Massachusetts Bay Colony and Plymouth Colony, but the victory over the Pequots, literally the massacre at the Mashantucket Pequot Fort, was declared a region-wide Thanksgiving. Massachusetts Bay Colony set aside October 12th as a special day of Thanksgiving for subduing the Pequots, and there was a similar Thanksgiving Day established after King Philip's War, when Metacom, Massasoit's son, was killed after that rebellion. His head was put on a pole, put in the middle of Plymouth Colony, and the day of his death was declared a day of Thanksgiving. So it makes me shudder sometimes to think that we rarely talk about that aspect of Thanksgiving. And even the way Thanksgiving became a national holiday owes much to the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln declared that we should have a day for celebrating the blessings of field and the fruits of the field, and it should be a national holiday. And that ties in with a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale, who thought we needed a day to celebrate the founding fathers and celebrate families coming together to feast. So, in a way, all of these American Thanksgivings over time have very little to do with celebrating Native presence on this landscape and have a great deal to do with claiming the landscape as English or as American territory devoid of Indians.
Well, that's a pretty tragic foundation to this holiday. And yet there was a kind of congress, I'd say, between the two peoples. When you're talking, I guess, before King Philip's War, before these massacres, there was a kind of connection. There was a feast at which the Indians and the Pilgrims came together. What's this about?
As I say, it's very strategic. To kind of back up for a moment, Squanto is often held up as a hero. And there are many children's books, and there are moments in curricula across the country where people teach about Squanto helping the Pilgrims. Squanto is seen to many Wampanoag people as a traitor. He was also seen in his own time as a direct traitor to Massasoit. Massasoit's strategy was to negotiate a very careful peace with this one colony in order to facilitate trade and in order to have allies in any potential conflict with other groups. Squanto tried to manipulate that for his own ends. A man named Hobomok, who lived very close to the Plymouth colony, was actually sent there to keep an eye on them, to watch over them. So the thing that's important to remember is that it was a strategic peace, it was a delicate peace, and it was never as stable as it should have been or could have been, in part because there wasn't balance on both sides. I'll give you a great example. There's a moment in the Plymouth colony records when Massasoit has gathered together a number of sachems to confirm this peace, and the terms of the agreement are reiterated over 20 times. Each sachem has to speak for his community and recaps the entire summary of what's just been said. And in the Plymouth colony records, the Pilgrims are saying, what is it with these people? Is it not good enough to say it once? But what you're seeing is a model of Native consensus. You're seeing the fact that every one of those Wampanoag communities has to assent that no one community can take another's fate into its hands. And even Massasoit, as a central chief, is responsible to all of those people. Whereas the English style of government is so dramatically different. What we call representative democracy means that one person is chosen to speak for everyone else. And they can often go off on their own and make decisions that might harm the entire community. So when you look at the leaders of the Plymouth colony, and when you look at the leaders of the Wampanoag communities, they're negotiating in dramatically different ways. And the Plymouth colonists are after one thing more than anything else, and that's land. They intend to expand. They intend to stay. They do not intend to allow Wampanoag people to hold on to their sovereignty.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Marge Bruschak, author of 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving.
The entire myth of this event as the so-called First Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that that was the first successful harvest they had had. And being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who, remember, had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out, and they hunt four deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food.
You mean with the fish?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? Have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family. That forgets the fact that this is native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine. And he's traveled down into this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, oh no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you. And she says, no, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you. And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields and they pile the earth over it and they watch and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there is the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Bemkikta, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman. And it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.